our mediator, moderator, will be one of the men who's been praying. I've heard him pray in the fellowships on Tuesday when we pray for the culture we share, for openness for dissension in our normal community, so we don't end up being mad, but give each other a sound of back rub, you know. And we should have some kind of a local community sound everywhere, I guess, but so a real conversation can happen. And I suppose that's part of what might just be said in introduction to this. I want him to do that, but just that.
I think, you know, one of the best introductions to this session this evening goes back to 1973. 1973 maybe wasn't quite as good a year as 1976. At least it was a year we weren't quite as happy about that went along. And it happened one week, in Holden Village even, that the word came back to the faculty from the guests. They said, why does everything turn out gloomy? The race situation, the economic situation, everything. What's going on here? Haven't you people got a happy word for us? And so we got together on Sunday and we said, let's declare Thursday is Hope Day. Nothing but uppers on Thursday. And so tonight is a night for uppers, so smile, everybody. Okay? We decided to get one jump ahead of you this time and declare an evening for the celebration of the fruition of the promises of God in our lives that we can see. Now, if you don't understand what we mean by the promises of God for our lives after the sermon tonight, I'm sorry about that. I won't be able to help you any. But I think we all have a sense of the promises of God that He is with us and that He will not forsake us and that the world is ours because of Him. And you say, yeah, but what have you done for me lately? And that's what we want to come together and talk about tonight.
Or my favorite Norwegian joke there, and it's the best one I think that I've seen. It was a New Yorker last November. One Norwegian to another says, Bob, sure got everything good here. And the other one says, yeah, that's all we got.
But there must even be real themes to this. There must be not only enough of a sense of God's yes so that we can be happy about it, but there must be real themes to develop, and so we've got a distinguished faculty here this evening to explore a little bit some of the ways in which in the world today we can look and say, yeah. Erling, what do you want to start off with?
My name was last on the list.
Well, that's all right. The last you'll be first. Erling Jorstad.
I don't know.
He's got to get his ideas from Paul and me, see?
Not tonight. Now, that's a challenge. You know, that's a challenge. I would like to give a little, I can't talk any other way except, I suppose, historically. And I'd like to start with what happened in America in the 1960s as a sign of some of the breakthroughs that have taken place. And some of the examples, I just want to give a couple of broad statements of general interpretation, then a couple of specific examples of where I see some things worth celebrating and some things worth having uppers for, because I think we've gone through a revolution, if you want, or a transformation in our society since around 1960. That's a convenient place that's so close to us, and yet it's so profound that I think oftentimes we can't really realize this. I'd like to draw for my authority on another good Scandinavian Lutheran historian, namely American historian, Sidney Ahlstrom, at Yale Divinity School, who argues that the 1960s were the great watershed, really, in all of American history. And his argument, and I want to use it as a beginning here, is that a profound transformation took place in American life and in American religious life and all kinds of different expressions because two things really were going on. In a way, they're sort of the beginning, the two sides of the same coin. There was a profound increase in the rights of the individual, of all sorts of different individuals and all sorts of different groups that were taking place. A much greater increase in the rights of the individual and the opportunities for individuals. At the same time, there was a great decrease in the pressures from society to conform to a certain norm. Let me explain what I mean by that. Primarily in the 1950s, I suppose, because of the Cold War and the pressures for what we used to call national security and so on, there was an enormous pressure on people to conform to a certain norm. And the only trouble was that the norm was something which a very small elite, a very well-educated, usually white, male, upper-middle-class, college-educated, you know, Reformed Protestant synod was. If it came from the Ivy League, so much the better. In 1960, as a marvelous example of this, Life magazine did a series on what we call the national purpose. as though we could sit down and decide, you know, Henry Luce could decide what the national purpose was, and that you know, Billy Graham pitched in his contribution to this and several others, and that sort of set the norm for what everybody should believe and the way they should act. The trouble was that this norm was a single norm, which was really very much, as I've suggested, male, white, upper middle class, rather wealthy, and all others had to conform to this sort of norm. Now, what happens in the 1960s is a sign, I think, of a real breakthrough here, is all this sort of thing comes down, and we have a much greater concern for the rights, the protection of the rights of the individual, and for freedom from the pressures of society on the individual. I'll give you just a couple of examples, because I know these people want to talk a lot. Just give you three, four examples of this. For instance, think of the increase in the kinds of ministry that we perform. Pastoral ministry really hadn't gotten off the ground for a long time. Now pastoral ministry is one of the most important and significant parts of the whole outreach of the organized church, because we consider that the kind of ministry we include in the realm of the pastoral represents the uniqueness and the worth and the value of each individual, and that each individual is worth caring for, and each individual is worth, you know, getting a good education and a good preparation for. Otherwise, you know, and therefore, we try to offer far more varied services in the churches than we ever had before, and this is growing. Or the new kinds of ministries, for instance, that didn't exist before, in things like apartments, or all apartment house ministries, or ministries to ethnic groups, all sorts of different kinds of ministries that never existed really in any significant degree before. Or take the whole ecology movement, I think is a very significant breakthrough here. Because always before, the justification had been, if it's good for business, if it's good, you know, for profits, if it's good for the corporations, it has to be good for the country.
For General Bull Moose, it's
I'd like to give my favorite example I think is my favorite sort of joke about the ecology movement. The only trouble is that it was true, was that there was a manufacturer in an Ohio plant who was pouring some sort of sludge out into a river. And the river took 17 miles to get into the Ohio, and some of the ecologists were saying, why don't you know, stop this, why don't we have a nice clean river? And his justification was that this river has to be a working river. We just can't have rivers out there that are clean and, you know, pure and everything else, that if anything existed out there in nature, it should be put to work. And if it worked for, you know, corporation profits, you know, so much the better. And I would suggest the breakthrough there is another one. A third one, and then I'll quit after this one, is the whole realm of consumer protection. Before, it used to be pretty much the old, you know, let the customer beware kind of approach. And now, even though it means more red tape and bureaucracy in our society, which aren't necessarily always the best thing, we are far more concerned with protecting the consumer. And we're protecting the consumers because we believe that individuals and individual rights are better. And just one last example. Praise the Lord for having no smoking sections in restaurants. Really.
And airplanes.
Okay. So much for a starter. Paul Bosch, would you take off from there?
Sure. My list duplicates some of Erling's, as a matter of fact. I'm in the campus ministry, as some of you may know, and every month I send a little report from our campus situation to our local churches. And for 2 years now, 75 and 76, the last report of the year has been Signs of the Kingdom, second annual Signs of the Kingdom. And in the spirit that Dick mentioned, that we want to show people signs of hope and God breaking through into our world, in 75 I had a list of 6 items, and in 76 I had a list of 7 items. I'm just going to read them because they're kind of freaky. They range all over the landscape, from politics to the environment. The first thing I had for 75 was the 55 mile an hour speed limit. That was new in 75, and I marked that as a sign of the kingdom, because for the first time in my life as a 45-year-old American male, it became clear to us that faster is not necessarily better. I had simply assumed that technology would make cars and vehicles that would constantly go faster and faster and faster, and the older I got, the faster I would be going in my vehicles. But in 1975, for the first time, we said, no, 55, please, is the speed limit. And what did we do? We saved gas and we saved lives. And that represents, I think, a significant change in American perceptions. Faster is not necessarily better. Bigger is not necessarily better, and so on. Okay, I have the resolution both of the Vietnam conflict and of the Watergate scandal as one of my signs of the kingdom. Two signs of the kingdom. A, that they were resolved at all, and B, the way they were resolved. I think Americans learned through those terrible traumatic days, and they learned a great deal. So I counted both of those things as signs of the kingdom. I counted in 1975 the human liberation movements as signs of the kingdom. Black liberation, women's liberation, those kind of things. We hadn't seen those for a long while. And the fact that minorities were listened, that America seems to be ready, as Erling has said, seems to be ready to tolerate diverse opinions, that seems to me to be a step in the right direction and a sign of the kingdom. I would put in there also the human potential movement, although we might have some argument about this later tonight. I'd be willing to stick my neck out and say that humanistic psychology generally and the human potential movement is also a sign of the kingdom, that people are being aided in these means. And finally, technology. I cited the rise of technology. Technology has given us a lot of problems, there's no question, including pollution of the environment and rape of the resources and so on. But in 1975, I bought myself one of these little tiny cassette tape recorders. It's about that big. You can put it in your pocket. It's only a little bigger than the cassette that it records. You know what I mean? Incredible technology. And any technology that can do that can't be all bad. Any technology that can put a plastic heart valve in somebody's chest can't be all bad. And I stand among you as a sample of that, too. So technology, I'm willing to celebrate, and I'm not with the hippies or others who say technology is terrible and we gotta throw it away. So that was my list in 75. My list in 76 is as follows, 7 items. First of all, the return of Amtrak's Lakeshore Limited. The Lakeshore Limited allows people now to go from the East Coast to the Midwest, first time in 20 years. And it's fabulous. Anybody who's been to Europe will tell you what a great thing a well-run railroad system is. Now, I'm not saying Amtrak is yet altogether as well-run as it should be.
Is Mr. Lortzen here yet? Has he come in? I mean, since he runs the Burlington Northern section of it.
Oh, really?
I wonder if he's in. He's coming with
us. But railroads are the most civilized way
to travel. He'd be glad to hear you say it.
They're just incredibly...
Are you here?
No.
You're just agreeing with me, maybe.
I might have been working on it.
Wonderful. Well, airplanes are not a very civilized way to travel, I don't think. But railroads are. And once we get them the way they are in Europe, the kingdom will have come a little closer. The next thing on my list for 76 was the recall of Red Dye number 2. That's the sign of the kingdom because it represents all the vast bureaucratic structures of a national government concerned, would you believe, about your health and mine. And a lot of people complain about the bureaucracies and how terrible it is to have all those agencies and things tripping all over each other down in Washington, D.C., but I'm sure Bob Andringa, who was on our faculty last week, would repeat what I'm saying here tonight, namely that most of these people are highly dedicated public servants and they want you to eat wholesome food. And I would guess that Americans eat among the most wholesome and finest foods in the world.
Except for bread.
Except for bread. We still have some work to do in the kingdom.
Every guy we're going to teach to make good bread up here that's with us.
Yeah. But the recall of Red Dye number 2, I put down that as a sign of the kingdom because we have a government bureaucracy, if you can imagine, that's actually concerned about people's health. The next thing on my list for 76 was the city of Toronto. I don't know how many of you have been to the city of Toronto. Maybe Minneapolis one of these days will get on my list too. But Toronto is a very human city. Huge metropolitan area, great shopping, ballet, symphony, art galleries, all that kind of stuff. And yet it's a city you can walk the streets at night without fear. It's clean. It's well run. There's a minimum of corruption. We were there for a couple of conferences in 76 and we were greatly impressed with the city of Toronto. City planners ought to look there and learn. I have also the CIA and FBI investigations. It could only happen in America. Isn't that right? The Church Committee, and he's done a great service, that whole committee and those investigations have done a great service to America, keeping watch on the watchdogs, that we don't turn into a police state. The next thing, the third last thing on my list for 76, was the increase, you may not have seen this, but I did on the campus, the increase of black and white friendships. There was a time, you know, in the height of the civil rights and so on, and just after black power and so on, when all the black students at the university would sit at the black table in the dining hall. No whites invited. They wanted to live in their own floors in the dormitories. They walked across the campus with their own kind. And in 76, for the first time, I saw a break in that, and I saw blacks and whites in conversation, and in obvious friendships in the dining halls and on the campus, and that's a sign of the kingdom. The last thing I have on my list is Minnesota's Clean Indoor Air Act, which is what Erling was referring to. Wonderful, far-reaching, forward-looking act. Some of you may know, Minnesota now has a law that you must divide restaurants and public places into smoking and non-smoking sections. And for those of us who don't smoke, it's a great thing. Would that every state were as farsighted. And the final thing on my list is Syracuse, my own city's sidewalk ramps for the disabled. I don't know whether you've noticed it in your cities or not, but our mayor has begun this project of putting up ramps at every curb, and it's beautiful, for the wheelchairs. And it may have been in restrooms, where there's a special restroom, you know, for the disabled. And that shows to me the growing up of a society that's beginning to learn how to care for its minority members. And that's a great thing. So that concludes my list.
What do you got, Carol?
Well, I'd say one word comes to me out of both there is it's very much to the fore on this, God's yea to us, and that's awareness. Awareness especially of community that small is beautiful in terms of community and also what it means to be a human community. And this all comes under that rubric. And I would want Paul Fanny to sit next to me because I think it's in part of turning from Calvin to Luther. And I would like to expand on that a little bit, but Paul not being next to me insisting staying back there, it's hard to attack him from here. But it is exciting in the sense that Luther felt that every revival in the church, first of all, began with awareness of language. Because the words you use shape you. Any of you who were at session this afternoon, I'm sure you got that back, because that's one thing Raleigh's great on here. But language is so all important to whatever is going to happen. And if you don't have time, slow down, you know, you don't have time for the language that actually refreshes both you and the person with whom you're sharing it. In fact, you bore them, and that you have no right to do. Paul says you're to study every person that you meet so that you may do what? Let your speech have salt and sparkle. Wit, he says, and grace. And your speech is you. Very real. In fact, Jesus says you're going to be judged for every unconscious word that goes out of your mouth. Not working, not being purposeful. Because that's you. It's the spillover of what's really you. That's the poetry that's you. And awareness is there. A very significant book, I think back at the beginning of the 60s, the introduction to which the doctor wrote it, now dead, was saying that no point even saying the way it ought to be. And this was, he's speaking about the mastery with which you approach each other and so on. But the first thing of all that would happen, he gave three list of three things that would happen in a truly human situation. First would be awareness. And in fact, he tells about being with a Chinese friend going to take a subway in New York up to Central Park, and his Chinese friend starts to get into one. No, he says, that's a local. There's an express coming. We get there 20 minutes faster. And they got to Central Park 20 minutes faster. They got out. He started to stride across Central Park. Oh, wait a minute. What are we doing in those 20 minutes we just did? Just let's sit down.
Beautiful.
And we're learning to sit down. We're having a sit-down strike against ourselves because you and I are paced to something different. We are, definitely. I mean, if you aren't busy, why aren't you? You see, I had my corporation meeting, and a friend who starts out with, you know, that I led him to the Lord some years ago, and I wanted to interrupt him by Dwight L. Moody's famous remark that I wish the Lord had and not me, you know, but anyway, he continued, and he'd rather pound a board in any building around here than hear a poem. See, he's still back on that big thing going. He's still on that, and I had foolishly sent some poetry to these fellows when I wrote to Muggridge, if God maybe was willing to pay his own way over here from London, which is quite a way, or England, and looking forward to being with us next year. That was a crazy poem, he just liked it. That's all. But I took time to write it. It takes time to write a poem. It takes time to read one. You can't hurry a poem. And you all have got one. You all are one. You've all got them. But you don't take the time, you see. Life is earnest. Life is real, you see. Even in prison camp where you think that's the one thing we had is time, the Calvinists walk like that. That's a fact. They still didn't. We'd sit there and laugh. Do you know what they call the Lutherans? This is a prison camp, remember, and pretty grim. They call Lutheran laughter. And then you could hear the difference. We'd walk down the floor. Junkin, Stonewall Jackson on his forebears, Woodrow Wilson, a great uncle, and life was earnest, life is real, still in prison camp. And he couldn't waste any time right in prison camp. Yeah. Well, you know, you just, that's one thing we had was time. And he was going to make use of it, you know. And it's allowing said to reach into you and just kind of allow you to be who you are. That's what we're going to pound home next year, thanks to one of our great theologians here in the village. Gertrude Lundholm is her name. And she insists it's about time you learn a little bit of what God has for your life, that he gives you time. I used this for one of my sermons yesterday, and the women getting in, because Nancy's going to be involved in this from the Old Testament. Paul and Carol are going to take Luther and leisure, because he's great. Just great on this. Just super, but awareness. You can't listen to Luther without being poor. That's why the Catholics are reading like crazy. It's like Philip Watson. Somebody asked him why he methods reading Luther. Well, for one thing, he's never dull. He never bores you. Philip Watson said about his book, Let God Be God. Incidentally, he wanted to write the second one, Let Man Be Man, and he felt the only place he knew on God's earth where that was happening, where both were happening, was Holden Village. He said, you've made both become concrete. Let God be God and let man be man. Time to be you. Time to be with each other. Time to enjoy the mystery of each other. Awareness. And then language comes out. Really, Luther, anything he touches turns to poetry. Not just all those hymns he wrote, which are that, of course, which will live forever. As long as men are men anywhere, they'll be singing them. But just in his ordinary prose, it turns to poetry. Like, for instance, everything in nature serves one another. The flower does not enjoy to attract, to enjoy her scent, but to attract the bee. The river does not flow to enjoy its murmuring, but to swell the sea. Only man, even in the midst of all creation, just when he is religious, yes, just when he is religious, goes on his knees to seize from God that which he would have for himself. See, good poetry, wasn't it? It is. It just does it. You can't forget it. I read that over and it just hangs in there. You can't forget it, you see. And they can't forget you. And that's what Jesus says. They'll remember your saying. If they've kept my saying, they will keep yours also, didn't they? Because every word that he shapes becomes an image, becomes something. You aren't just up there occupying a space. One of our blacks, in fact, the only one we had a kitchen for any time this year, had a beautiful matinset before he went on cornflakes and straight people, and nobody will eat cornflakes again without thinking about that matinset. He stuck cornflakes to our life for the rest of our life, and it was really delightful. Well, this is what you do. Boxes, you can't mention boxes around here any time of the year, but people start to laugh and think of Erling's famous Vespers last year in boxes. He even has boxes in which to keep boxes about boxes. But the joy of language that allows you to enjoy each other. Now, the Chinese have a strong sense of this. One reason why they look forward to old age, and they look forward to old age, they don't dread it. They look forward to old age as a time to enjoy the savor of a phrase. Let it roll around, let it sit with you, to enjoy a little poem like Li Po's when he'd been knocked out by the emperor and sent into exile, and he writes a little poem about it all, that someday, he says, some people hope that when they have a child, he will be brilliant, a genius. I do not. I hope when I have a son, he will be stupid and ignorant, that someday he may grow up and become prime minister. And it's, you know, just that, you can't forget it, you know. See, this is a people that have had a feeling of awareness. And I think we're getting it, even in our busy civilization. And I think maybe that's enough to start it with, but one could spend it. I could say one more little thing. I think that history at this moment is at a turning point, a new birth. Certainly it's a coming again. It's in a real sense a coming again of Jesus in a new way. And if people want to build that one up more, they're welcome. I all power to them. Personally, I accept the fact that we've been through a period in our history since Christ that we were under a kind of tutelage of authority. And we know it is a Roman Catholic period of authority, and we call it the Petrine period. And now we've been under a period in which we've been under the awareness of the person and the individual and his relationship. And some people call it the period of Luther. I'd rather hand it more to Calvin and say Luther's coming into his own finally. We're going to realize community and what it means to be evangelical Catholics and embrace one another in a new sense of community. And that's what's breaking through. Some people call it the period of John because it kind of starts with John the 23rd as well as the Gospel of John, seeing it kind of unites. And I very firmly think that's this moment. And why not be with it?
You can imagine my problem trying to be the moderator of this and contribute something to this discussion with these people around. And so I thought, well, I'll pull a fancy one on them. There's one magazine that we get in this village that not very many other people do, and there was an article in it that just really turned me on this time. It's the Smithsonian. I like that one. And there's an article in the latest one which contained a term which really excites me. The term is appropriate technology. Can you imagine technology having to be appropriate? And finally we make a turn, not the ultimate technology toward which we strive, bigger and better or faster and whatever, but no, out of all the technologies of which we have such a superabundance, which one is appropriate for these people in this society, in this place and time? Now that's a question that's been a long time waiting to be asked. And we've got to the point where we have so many technically trained people and so many scientifically trained people and so much technical know-how and so many problems we aren't solving anyway, that it's about time to ask the question, well, just what would be right for these people in this time?
And the answer is not always, well, it's the latest thing that Americans are doing. A little example was the case of a developing nation where they got to the point where in the development of their agriculture they needed to collect and pack and ship eggs, and they wanted to make their own egg cartons. And how do you make egg cartons, for goodness sakes, in the world in 1976? Well, the egg carton making machine costs $450,000, and it makes a million cartons so in some period of time, and all of Africa doesn't use that many eggs. No kidding! The present technology for packing eggs is too big for the continent of Africa. You can only buy them in Poughkeepsie, and you got to get parts from there. So somebody had to go back and invent a new egg carton making machine, which would do something else, for goodness sakes, when you got enough egg cartons. And make one for $19,500 that they can have and own and fix themselves and use for all kinds of things. Find not the way to make egg cartons, but a way that is right for these people in this place at this time. Well, isn't that nice? The same goes for power. We come to realize that perhaps it is just not appropriate that all of the world should get its electric power from Grand Coulee Dam. Maybe not even all of the Northwest. And that maybe the idea that power should be generated in great massive places where nothing else happens and from which the power lines radiate into all the civilized world, that may just not be the answer, you know. And so there are under design and under construction power systems which begin and end in a community in which the resources of the community, sunshine and wind and fertilizer and animal wastes and vegetable wastes, go together to make the kinds of energy that this little community uses, and they learn to live with that, and they don't need to either import or export. Very interesting, and probably a great deal more appropriate. Another case, just to cite one. We celebrate American agriculture because in this time American agriculture makes the difference between what is needed by the people and what is produced by everybody outside of America. And we ship food because we can produce more food than we need, and that makes us very unusual. But there is a strange thing about the great American system of agriculture, that in the net, it consumes more energy than it produces. All right, you can't eat coal, and you can't eat oil, and you can't eat diesel fuel. But BTU for BTU, the American system of agriculture, is a net consumer and not a producer. For all, even not counting the number of BTUs of sunlight it uses for photosynthesis. Just the BTUs it uses from fuels, most all of which are irreplaceable. You don't get out that many British thermal units of food value. Now, you can't export that system to the rest of the world because you can stand only so much of that. And we can't tell the rest of the world, look, you wouldn't go hungry if you did like we do. If they all did like we did, the whole thing would collapse before you and I are gone and not pass the problem on to our grandchildren. We'd run out of fuel before you and I are dead. All right? So what we need is not the ultimate technology to be given to everybody, that would be the ultimate disaster, but we need appropriate technology for this time and this place and these people. And just to hear people on the national scene and the international scene talking this way and working this way and planning this way is a great excitement to me. So what are you people thinking about? Tell me about your, where do you see signs of hope in the world today, if not in the Smithsonian Magazine?
Come ahead.
One I thought of just when they're thinking is the Congress voted down the SST.
Yeah. Which is, I celebrated, who else celebrated? Yeah. Anybody else happy about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. Just because we could go fast, we didn't go faster just because we could.
Then we would have a few more minutes to get home from the farther out airport where the SST lands.
Okay. Just like when I play Scrabble, I get blocked on one word, maybe get a better one. Iboine is doing some better things, even in ecology, in poor ecology. So, yeah, garbage disposal, uses of waste, and so on.
Has anything
some more now? There's lots. Come on in.
Oh, I know something.
Yeah.
It kind of celebrates humanness in the city, and that's the wonderful new freeway over the freeway park in downtown Seattle.
And over the freeway park. Tell me, how do they do that?
Just read your new issue of Sunset Magazine, folks. It doesn't do the
We've been there.
It does
really?
The article.
Tell
it's
us about
beautiful.
It.
Yeah, the article doesn't give it justice. It's much better than the article.
Well, what have they done?
Well, with grants from the federal government and the state government and the city of Seattle and people, private people who have owned land, this is right in the core of the city between the up First Hill and big IBM buildings and all those buildings. They've taken land along and airspace over the freeway, which they deemed, since the freeway was on Seattle territory, the airspace belonged, the property belonged to the city of Seattle. So they made this bridge, it's just one huge kind of bridge, and there's huge cement containers for trees and lawn and wading pools and a canyon.
The freeway then goes effectively underground.
I-5, Interstate 5.
Wow.
And there's a canyon of waterfalls.
Where is that now? Because I have a condominium in Seattle, but I'm there so little.
Seneca Street.
Seneca goes right through.
8th Avenue
and
goes right through.
8th Avenue and Seneca. That's in that part.
It's finished and it's working. And
yeah, it's gorgeous. Ooh. It was dedicated on the
4th of July. Flowers bloom on the freeway.
And they have this the canyon of waterfalls, and it, what you hear is water and not cars and trucks.
Great.
And it's, don't you think that's really neat in the middle of the city?
Fabulous.
All these older folks that are living in retirement homes right on the edge of the downtown area, they have a park to go to. People have a park to go to. During lunch hours, we work in the business area.
The park is built on
top of the freeway.
Top on piers, I suppose, huh?
Massive bridge. It's blocked. You don't know, it's not that expensive to look at.
You mean they build a bridge over the freeway and it's for some other purpose than to run another car over it?
No, that's
enlightenment.
That's
very...
All right.
And that becomes a symbol of a lot of things. You don't have to feel guilty about putting money out and using space for something that, in a real sense,
is useless,
is non-productive.
Yeah.
Along that same
now,
line,
that's where we're at right now. This is the moment that we're at.
Along that same line, but not so grandiose. There was quite a bit of squabble about some certain small parks, you know, like size of this building, this type of thing in the city. And I didn't really think too much of myself until one day I drove by, and it was the first day of sunshine we had after some considerable rain. And here were these people with their quirkers with their lunch sacks out there eating and that. And I thought, oh, that's right, that's good. If you use it that much and enjoy it that much, it's worth it.
Best pockets
parks. The cities are doing this. Many parks and
best pockets
going on all over.
Oh, and Seattle's got so much fascinating anyway, because the old market has still been kept. Pioneer Square has been kept. Boy, it's been great.
Okay.
The enjoyment of your environment as such, huh? Okay.
What's upstairs?
No, right here, Barbara.
Oh, yeah.
This is sort of in line with your appropriateness of technology. This refers to scientific research. I think it's rather of interest of the geneticists. I don't know if you're aware. I'm going to talk tomorrow night about some of the research that is being carried on. But they recently held a moratorium. In other words, the scientists have gotten together themselves and are holding a moratorium on certain kinds of research. Again, feeling is all of this appropriate or not, and some of it could be potentially dangerous, and so, and they're holding a moratorium on this.
It's one thing to be reining in somebody else's horse, but to see somebody rein in his own horse is really...
Is this the one where they're trying this dummy one where they had the actually electric shock treatments to see if people would accept authority? That statement that
what I'm specifically referring to are some experimentation they're working with small segments of DNA, which we'll talk about, which is the molecule of life. In other words, they're placing this into bacteria, but you see potential danger. What if they create some new bacteria that could be like the Andromeda strain?
Mm-hmm.
Some of the research is pretty wild, what's going on, but they are aware of
the dangerous trees and so on, placing
them. They're starting to build their own fences.
And I think the response to the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is a good example. A rejection of authority for its own sake, and a glorification of I know it was a great role for an actor, but it was still a great message that came through, too.
Easter pageant, Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
Larry.
I'm excited about what's happened the last 10 years in terms of lay people going out to witness in churches, the lay renewal movement in the Lutheran church, the lay witness movement in the Methodist church. I think it's turning the churches, bringing them alive.
This is capitalizing on the mobility that people have in our society. They don't just have to stay in the same town and work the same schedule all the time. And when they don't, when there are more people with the freedom to move, they're getting out and carrying the message, among other things.
Some of you come from backgrounds which don't realize how radical this is that he's saying. Now, the Methodist Church is built on really lay preaching. In the Lutheran Church, only the Scandinavians had it. And one of the resistance to the merger of the ALC and the ELC was this tradition within the Scandinavians. And for instance, I teamed up with a so-called theologian from the ALC, and I thought he had a great sense of humor until the second meeting I realized he really meant it, because they'd ask him a question, and he'd look up in Jacob's Index. If it wasn't in Jacob's, it wasn't a question that should be answered, and since there weren't any lay preachers in the Index, obviously they shouldn't exist. But that mentality was what opposed this place, you see. There should not be reflective lay people permitted to be involved in theology, because that means that us pastors might have to also get a little bit of theology as well as golf and other things into our schedule. And it was a real threat. Many people fought it. They thought it was real wrong. I mean, just look what's happening. I mean, I just think when I hear lay preaching every day here, and great lay preaching, matins and vespers and so on, wow, you're surrounded with it, and how the whole church shares a proclamation. Good for you bringing that up, because it is a real move forward, and it's been the sign of every revival in the church. I think one guy's chairman of a call committee right now, and he has a bishop that isn't the most gifted in what he's got between his ears, to put it very mildly, and the bishop said, don't think it's time you're having an administrator there now in that parish. It's gotten so big. Now, instead of getting a preacher and a pastor, you get an administrator who's also instantly ordained to be the administrator. So then you got to find a layman like Paul to be the theologian, like the Presbyterian Church does there where he is in Santa Monica. But he answered, we laymen can supply those gifts if we get a man that'll motivate us. I see there's a maturity.
Back here.
Pretty soon, yes. Yeah. Al, picture, way back.
Hiding in the corner. I know three things, all of whom have given up, in some sense, the rapids. You can interpret it different ways. One is highly trained professionally, and a good job in his profession. But he thought it would just be too demanding on him. And he's given it up for the search for something else, which is not going to take 60 or 70 hours a week, and then in 50 or 60 or 70 thousand dollars a year, his profession would have. I don't know where they're going, but it's clear that they have decided not to get caught in a professional career orientation. And some professions just, I know another person with 25 years, family in which the man is 25 years, a very successful professional experience, and he just quit. And I know another family that did somewhat the same thing. And all are looking for patterns of human existence, which in a sense say no to some of the dominant trends in our society and the dominant career images of success. And it seems to me people are asking questions about where meaning can be found. And I don't suggest that it's unambiguous, that it's clear that this is the way to go. It seems to me they've heard the call to be human and not simply to get caught in career orientation. And it takes a lot of courage on the part of both the man and the woman and the families that are involved. And I know there are lots of other people I can think of these two. And all of them have been at Holden this year. And I think Holden in some ways is responsible for it, but I don't want to get into thoughtful Chicago chain there. It's just that it's really a nice. Society which demands so much of us in a way of taking our time and energy just to exist, all of these families, that somehow we're going to exist without it taking time and energy.
So Al is celebrating the rebirth of three of his friends at an advanced age.
Courage.
And courage it takes.
Courage
and rebirth.
And down a little lower in the age bracket, something we were talking about when Bob Andringer was here was the stop-off thing, because when I went through, it was just necessary to get right through college, get right into graduate school, get right out working right away, and then worry about it later, and reflect back later. And there wasn't a thought at all about taking time off to reflect and see where you were going, simply to get on the achievement syndrome as quickly as possible. And I think the stop-off thing, which is now the norm rather than the exception, is a sign that we're much more conscious of where we are going or where we should be going.
Maybe know what it means.
Well, the stop-out is where if you're going on to college or going into a career and you're not sure about it, you simply take off 3, 6, 9, 12 months, whatever it might be. You might drop out of college after a year or two or whatever it might be. You might take a year off before you go to college, or you might think you're going to go to college and then you try a year and you don't go to college at all. And the stop-out movement simply means that you're taking time off, but there's nothing necessarily, you know, good in itself for getting the degree as quickly as possible and getting out there and started earning as quickly as possible. And one real sign is the less dependence of young people in the 20s on a higher standard of living by comparison to us than we went through. They're much more capable of doing with much less than we were.
They're willing to learn from Socrates. Go ahead.
What's that?
Also, the dropping of the Selective Service made that impossible.
You can plan your own life.
You put me in mind of another possibility that we could put on our list. The refusal, as I hear it anyhow, of a lot of middle management and junior executive types to move their families when the corporation says move. I've heard that this is a growing phenomenon in businesses, that when IBM says you move now to, you know, halfway across the country, the people are quitting instead of moving. You know, IBM has a big operation in New York State, and they say, you know what IBM stands for? I've been moved. But why should it be that business and industry have to move people around and uproot them so much? I think that's being challenged.
We're right on now what we're going to really push next year, and that's the directions that God has given us in the Old Covenant law of blessing our lives that gives us some little backup for this. The fact that when you get married, the Old Testament says you're to take 1 year for your honeymoon. 1 year.
Terrific idea.
No, that's what the Old Testament law says. Because it's that important to know the person you're married to so you don't split up after 5 or 7 or 10 years.
You've got 51 weeks to go.
Yeah, you were supposed to get a whole year. Pick them up. Yeah, and every seventh year sabbatical.
Yeah, I heard her.
I'll go along with that.
I heard that. I heard that society in the Middle Ages had something like 150 holidays a year. Was it that many? It was over 100 anyhow. It was over 100.
Every third day was a community festival. The person who develops this, and it's very simple to read, and it's in the bookstore, and it'll be background for, I think, for next year too. It's a Roman Catholic theologian at Bonn, and that Pieper is named, Joseph Pieper, and I think it's simply Festivity is Communal or something like that, the title. But just take a look at it, because it's a very easy read, unlike his other books, but it sums up everything he's been saying. That you can't capture joy alone. Joy has to be shared.
I don't know whether you're doing that, but Father and Dream, but he's going back in week.
Now, there's an innovation in job holding, which I like, where, and Millie would just really like something like this too, where two people have a job instead of one person having a job. Now, I don't mean two half-time people who get hourly wage. I mean a full professional job, which is just chopped in half, and you give half of the professional salary to each person, and these two people handle it. And, yes?
I have a cousin in Minneapolis, the first time it's happened in Minneapolis, the two gals are making a proposal to share a teaching staff in the public school.
Does it look as if it'll be approved?
She doesn't know if the proposal will win.
Oh, got a good chance.
Sounds very good.
Got a good chance.
Pray for that one.
Yes.
What's happening is very troubling.
Stay on. One call?
One call, two people.
Two theologians?
Yeah.
Ha ha!
Yeah. But in most, I know Presbyterian couples in Seattle and Bellevue, and they love it, and it's terrific, and the congregation loves them. Because what they do, they, each of them, they really get two for the price of one, but they're not working as much as they would if they said one job.
Are they actually getting cheap coolie labor, though, Nancy?
No,
I mean, what I mean is, are the couples themselves under this guilt thing that they really better produce and they really better work? But what I mean is, are they really working full weeks?
No, they're not working full weeks.
Good.
Earlier, you said that they invited the children, they're working 7 days.
Can't hear you, Al.
Gustavus, if anybody here can help, there's a couple that have half and half on a teaching appointment. How's it working?
Good.
I heard, though, on the other thing with the team ministry, it came up yesterday in our discussion that some places it doesn't work so well. Because the two styles of ministry aren't necessarily compatible. And if you have the right idea, the right combination. Was it anybody here at our discussion here yesterday on that?
Well, I think the male has to celebrate the superiority of the female in certain areas. We had a good discussion through the night now at one of our seminaries just this spring that asked me down for their graduates, and the prof there was saying the toughest minded theologian we've got in the church today is Mary, my wife. And I had to ground her because of the fact that it didn't help the villager going around talking and people saying, well, why can't we have a preacher who's like that, you know? And I said, you're not helping the village. You got it. I asked Gullickson about her when I was at the seminary. I said, I mean, here's this tremendous speaker. She inherits her grandfather's gifts, who was the greatest preacher we've had in America, Hoimy. And she's just something. And in fact, people used to say, we like Oscar, we'd rather hear his son-in-law, we'd rather hear his wife most of all. That's what you used to say around him. But in those days, you couldn't do it. It was too threatening to the guy. It wasn't threatening me. I enjoy it. She gets mad when I say this.
One of the beautiful things about appropriate technology is the fact that we get off this idea that a thing has to be perfect. All right, suppose you buy an oil tanker that displaces 500,000 tons. It is 10 times as big as the Bismarck. And it's just an oil tanker. Well, now that thing just doesn't dare to fail. I mean, if that thing fails, you pollute the whole Atlantic Ocean all in one sploosh. Suppose that you have the power for the state of Oregon produced in one great nuclear reactor hid up in the mountains. You don't dare have that go wrong. There's no room for mistakes. None of this frequent mistakes business. No mistakes at all, sorry. Because one and that's it. Now, that's a terrible way to live. That's like this career where you've got to go, win every one or you'll never be president, see? And if you lose one once, you go on the discard pile and they look for some bright young man who's not losing any, see? Oh, what a terrible model for society. Why not one of these things where I get in my licks today and somebody else gets in his licks tomorrow and we sort of share our various talents and we get used to each other's possibilities and limitations. And this creates a system that can celebrate even mistakes once in a while. And wouldn't that be a little bit more appropriate as a model for the way a society works? Because I just don't believe there's a system that doesn't make mistakes. I think that it just makes bigger and bigger and bigger mistakes and it'll never admit them. And we know a little about that, don't we?
Yeah. No, when you can share them, then things can happen. You can begin anew and let the past no longer capture you. It's when there's only two points of view, the wrong one and mine, that you haven't got a chance. I mean, there's no conversation, there's no family, nothing. I wanted to tell the story Sunday, and I didn't, but it was a conversation when we were leaving Norway once, and I was in to thank this fellow for his really delightful family. Bjarne Harreid, his name was, and he was in charge of religious education in the schools in Norway at that time. Very wealthy man in his own right, but just tremendous kids. And he said, why is it? He says that really, no, bad Christians, he said, like you and me, have great kids, and good Christians have such bad kids. And I said, because you and I always have to ask forgiveness from our kids. He says, yeah, you're right, that's right. Well, it is true. Then it's open, you see. Then you, the conversation is possible. I can learn from my kids even, which I quite frequently have to do. I don't like it always, but... And sometimes it's a very noisy process, but...
Talking about the same people
and
the same kind of
work.
She doesn't want to marry another
pastor. Oh, okay. How does she know? She hasn't met the guy.
Maybe there is one. That's right. She may well eat those words.
Well, it wouldn't just have to have the husband and wife both be pastors. Maybe you could have... Maybe you could have two half-time pastors and two families.
And your feedback is so enriching, even if it's in the same interest. Like Mary was reading to me William Stringfellow's lecture from Seattle Day, and they are exciting. I wouldn't even have seen them if you weren't reading them to me.
I don't think we're looking for a system that can't fail. I think we're looking exactly for a system that can fail so that we can work at it. And... one whose failures we can survive. I don't know of anything that God has given us on this earth, however, whatever its great potential, that can't fail, that can't go wrong, and that we can't louse up once in a while.
That's why our answer to our Japanese guards, and I was wishing they'd ask me the question they quite frequently asked others, they never asked me, whose side's going to win? The side that isn't afraid to hear what the other side has to say. Because then you're open to your mistakes. The trouble with Hitler, he finally was believing his own lies. That's what they're feeding him back again. He couldn't get information anymore. That was Nixon's problem. He'd isolate himself and you could only tell him. Then, like Kissinger said so well, you know, it's possible for even a paranoid to have enemies.
My psychiatrist tells me I'm a paranoid, but he just says that because he hates me.
Well, this openness is what we're talking about, isn't it? And it is one of the blessings of the multiple kinds of input that we have in our American scene is just this. The fantastic enrichment of our society that's available to us that we haven't begun to exploit. Even in our theology is so hybrid from Germany, it makes me scream because it's done by guys who think theology exists for theologians. They actually do. I mean, I used to say in my own faculty seminary when I was on it for a little while, there's no theology except the lay theology. All the rest is stamp collecting. That is just an interesting hobby if you like it. But it has absolutely no meaning whatever, except gathering footnotes. How many footnotes have you collected? But what's happening in the church is the theology of the church, that's all.
Our American system seems to delight in producing a standard product. You know, if you're going to produce something, you should be able to define the process of production and define the finished product. And the beautiful thing about our educational system is that it utterly fails to do that. And that you graduate a whole class of people with the same degree at the same age, and there are not two that are anything alike. And the farther you go with them in the process, the more different they become, instead of the more they become alike. And nobody has found a way to beat this yet.
And I'm so glad. You want them to become alike.
And I'm so glad, yes. But this failure of the system is a cause for rejoicing.
Very much.
It's all been very fascinating and then some real ideas brought up. But I'd like to put something kind of simple. We talked about this beautiful park and structure being made. In the last 15 years, there's been more vandalism than ever. And it's just terrible the amount of vandalism goes on schools and parks today. If a group here put their minds to it, what could they do towards resolving that? I think government is I've seen many of the people in government have seen the mistakes. They know what the people want. What can we do to help them? What can we do to help them bring it back in line with honesty in government? What can we do to teach young people that are frustrated or something, or they wouldn't be destroying as destructive as good, and it's not all young people.
There's an excellent book that answers you, I think, well in it, and it's been hinted at before on Toronto and its particular system. Jane Jacobs, The Rise and Fall of the American City. And this is exactly what Jimmy Carter meant when he said ethnic purity. And I hate what our media can do on something like that, because they picked it up once or twice from the South. What he means is keep the blacks in their place. That was not what he was meaning at all, and the blacks knew it. What he means is that as long as you have real community, you have community watchers, you have community herders, you've got people who are concerned that this, for instance, this little kid up here in our very first group of kids rejected by their fathers, the runt of the pack in his family, no teeth already. Of course, Dennis got converted that year, and we sent him over, and he got all his teeth fixed up. Werner is just about 2 inches taller than he was, so his suits could be remade, so we got him a suit. You should have seen that kid dive. He would have made the Olympic team if the community had backed him, Leavenworth over there. And he came to me one day, he said, I want to get baptized. I said, why? Well, up here, everybody reminds me of future. At home, they always throw my past up against me. Fine, I can't think of a better reason for baptism. You're going to be baptized. Mary and I stopped down at Leavenworth in the tavern that serves hamburgers after midnight in winter, the only place open, and the big fat gal comes up, and she's, and of course, isn't long before everybody knows I'm from Holden Village, wherever I go for some reason, and she says, well, how's little Dillinger doing up there? That's why you've got that mess. The good people do it to them. They don't expect them anything else. They aren't capable of anything else, and therefore you make them into that.
But what can the good people do?
Well, they can start building them up and giving them a chance in terms of just permitting other kinds of environments to happen for them. I think when that came out, most clear to me was looking at case histories in Roosevelt Road back in the 30s. Hot day, about 110, going through these series of flats, the only water was a pipe open down in the yard, no water in the building at all, and reading the case history of these families, rape and everything you can think of, forced prostitution. One little black girl now studying at the university and at the Chicago Art Museum in art. In second grade, a teacher got her imagination. Instead of living in the filth of that neighborhood, she lived into that teacher. And that teacher literally was the bridge for her out of that hellhole into a career that was meaningful. One person. And that, boy, that really meant a lot to me as I was reading that. That's what we can be to them. One person can be that. And help them to find a new hope, a new image of themselves, and a new kind of inspiration to fight through and make something of themselves. But that's a hopelessness at work in all vandalism. I can tell you because I've been a part of it. I mean, I grew up in the Norwegian ghetto of Minneapolis, and I can tell you, we took part in vandalism. And we took part in it because why? All we heard was, well, if there weren't so many of you dumb Swedes around here, because that's the worst insult you could give a Norwegian, there wouldn't be a depression. We'd all have jobs. What do you do on those terms? You go and break their windows, don't you? That's just what we did. We went over and smashed their windows for them.
That's one type of vandalism. What about the middle and upper class vandalism?
That you get in a dine out of boredom.
Yeah. Well, I think much of what we see in the decay of the cities and in the sickness in the society is simply a result of those developments which, in some case, we have seen beginning to turn around. This business of build the system, the technology, the business, the system. Build it because it simply must reach whatever potential is there. We must have the best of everything, and we must build the best, and so on. And people say, yeah, but what about me? You know, why should we build the best this and the best that? And why should everything be oriented to that one person who can rise to the top? You see, you know, I just don't really believe that. There was a lot going on in American society that the generation coming up just wasn't about to buy. And here we are 20 or 30 years later, and they are the people who are just making the turn in our society. And they're saying, well, maybe there isn't one standard of performance for every kid in high school. And maybe there isn't one way of running a business for every business on the main street. And maybe there isn't just one way of doing this or that, and get honor the person who does it best and chuck everybody else aside. We just rejected an awful lot of people and told them that they're not worthwhile, and they told us, well, we'll show you. We'll show you who you better pay attention to. I think that our society is coming around to where some of the people who were so easily rejected a generation ago are honored for their worth in the society today.
I'm not what, very yes. optimistic about
the, Al?
About the situation. If you take the whole situation, you take the city of Chicago, you can't walk in the street, the police can't do anything, and I'm not very optimistic about that. If we're going to answer really seriously the questions about order, you don't know what to do about the disorder of our city. Nobody's got an answer. And there are a lot of books written and a lot of research, and we don't need knowledge. We need to start living it. What is the yay for me is the fact that some people are beginning to say, well, we've got to live differently in different meetings about you. Our whole culture is going to be changed, but it's no great big answer to the...
No.
You know, we're going to live with cities that are uninhabitable. And who was telling me about St. Louis? There's a guy down. It's just almost a shell.
Right. Over here, please.
Why did that thing happen? Oh. I would react to that from the same point of view from the same city of Chicago. I think, to a large degree, what we've seen the city and the decay of the city, we've seen a lot of kind of solutions coming from without the city, and people saying, this is how you solve the decay of the city. Where I see the yay of the city is in the block clubs and those kinds of things. That 2 weeks ago I was out on the street with a block club sweeping the streets. Now that, to me, is joy.
Yeah, there's the possibility. That's the impossible possibility that's there. Yeah. Don't you think that's an impossible possibility that can happen? I mean,
Oh, of course it can happen. All I'm saying is it's not going to happen overnight.
No.
Solutions. It's going to be people changing their styles of living in relation to each other.
And those wounds. I mean, I remember going to our meat market in our area to buy that beautiful lutefisk, you know, and here's Eric Severide, Carl Nicholson, the Methodist theologian, got killed in Toledo, and we're all living that block. We're Norwegians in there, and he's the German that wouldn't sell that stuff to a bunch of you dumb herring chokers. I'm not going to be, you know, and gives us that vituperative kind of remark. Doesn't do us any feeling about the Germans. It makes us very happy, and we're just put down, you know. It's a bunch of herring chokers, you know. Well, this sort of thing is hard to get over in your life. It doesn't get over at once. Then you see beautiful people like these blacks and what they do with it. What we did with it is get more ambitious. So you got to listen to, you know, that small town Norwegian from Belva, North Dakota, give you a little moralism every night on CBS if you turn it down. Now, since Vietnam War is over, there's no big issue. He sounds just like the old preachers that didn't know the gospel. And you're getting it every day. And Eric's doing a good job on it. I mean, it's beautiful. It's an urbane job. You'd never know that his father had a little accent and that he might have had one that he's gotten over. Like all the rest of us. We speak sort of a Minnesota American.
Well, our economist says 28% of black teenagers are unemployed.
Yeah.
From 18 to 24.
What are they going to do except run riot?
And now, your black club can begin to try to get some of those jobs, and that's the concrete stuff you got to try to work for. But it's a big jump, and I don't think we have to minimize the tragic kind of time we're going to go through before some of these yays begin to produce.
Well, it is a birth pang, though, isn't it? I mean, the yays are in a birth pang always, aren't they? I don't think it's possible till Christ comes it'll be anything else. That's what I call triumphalism, if you're going to expect to get it without the birth pangs. And somebody's going to have to hurt. Courageous action. Frequent mistake. But you don't let go of the bold design. And it's so exciting, this meeting of all these varieties in an affirmative sense. So we're appreciative of each other. You know? This is the thing that really is getting through to me.
Some time ago, there was a term in use, Lake Erie, I think was it, they called about a dead lake that men had killed. And a lot of people went to work on that, and they discovered that if you would quit making it worse, it would get better by itself. And that was a wonderful discovery. And it has happened since then. And Lake Washington over by Seattle is a case in point. They did manage to quit making it worse, and it's beautiful.
You know, the next chapter in Lake Erie, they banned in Erie County, which is Buffalo, my home, they banned, what you call it, household detergents. Phosphates, what am I saying? This was a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. Not industrial, but just household, and the lake cleared up 60%, and they're catching fish in Buffalo Harbor that they haven't caught in 20 years. Mm-hmm. Another sign of the kingdom.
Things are possible that we had despaired of.
Yeah.
And if one thing that we despaired of becomes possible, who knows but what the next the same. And
but as Al says, it takes time. And a historian deals with time, but very few of us are historians in America. If it ain't going to happen now, what good does it do me? Mm-hmm. See, that's sort of the thinking. And that's why I say the wonderful thing is awareness of community. Maybe it's going to be a little different for my great-grandchildren. For that, I fight. And for that, I got into so much trouble that they didn't want me in the youth department anymore. But I was thinking, I want my great-grandchildren to want to belong to the church and not be in it, because for me, it was my tribalism. For me, not to be in the church would have been to betray my race, not just my Savior. It was Norwegian Lutheran Church. You know? Sid Randall will tell you the same story. Exactly. And so I put up with this whole brutality of the death of the intellect and no imagination and so on, like the Norwegians are also famous for, some of them, and especially when they become churchmen, and all for the sake of the tribe. Well, I knew my great-grandchildren weren't going to do it for the sake of the tribe. They'd have to have a church they want to be a part of, because it's exciting. And where else is it so exciting? And that's what we're going to have, because this is a preview. What you've got here is going to happen elsewhere. It's nothing unusual about the place that makes it possible. It's you people together that put it together, and you people are all over the place. It's going to happen elsewhere. It's going to happen as soon, too, as we get daring enough. Like I told my son on Cambridge, if I were he in this sort of bedroom town now for Madison, Wisconsin, I would have it across the board, and there'd be a layman in charge every night. We'd have family vespers, and it wouldn't be the same night in the same church, so you couldn't say Tuesday night's going to be Roman Catholic Church, or Friday night's going to be in the Norwegian Methodist, and so on, because there's one of them there. That's where they got started. But across the board, and before you know it, people are excited about each other, affirming each other, and finding out the riches that God has given to us in this place through one another that we're going to start making use of. And you'd be surprised how much of there is in every town. Sometimes the people have never seen. It wasn't until my last Sunday in Manitowoc that people dared show me the one black they kept in a back room in one of the homes there in Manitowoc, a city of 28,000. And Al knows about it, because I used to always feel just like, well, like I felt in Heidelberg now, or where are the Jews? There was a reason why there were no blacks. They didn't have to worry about any kind of, you know, anti-black feeling. There were none around. All that possibility, the discovery of each other and what we're missing because there isn't more openness for other kinds of culture. And I'd like to say one more thing here there, which for me is great meaning. I know Larry feels about TV quite negative, and I realize it's possibilities. Just because we don't get much here, and it isn't much good what we do get, when you go out, you really do affirm it. We had a tremendously good movie by the same fellow that did Equus on Friday night, just a dandy. We're going to try to get up here. But to see the Olympic Games, to have them come right there, to have this sense of it being caught by the emotion of the nations meeting, it was great. I'd never be able to afford to go to one, but there it was coming to me. You know, just, and then a review of for a whole hour of what had been happening amongst the Democrats, so I could see and hear them something. Just what you are able to capture, and on a day which you had some leisure to get it, because very few people could take out the time during the Democratic Convention to watch that, but here they got what was meaningful out of it. That's just great, I think, to me, what we're able to be a part of.
It seems then that there's little excuse for the Christian to be without hope in our present time. Well, there's no shortage of problems. There's no shortage of situations in our society that need improvement. But neither is there any reason to be without hope. There are abundant signs that the human condition can be improved, and that the needs of people can be met better by our society than there are now, and that people working in the will of God can can do something for themselves and can do something in society. And it doesn't need to be as gloomy as it was.
Well, there is hope. And all I have to say from this, like Saul says, look at me, Paul, now Paul, an apostle. And I only have to say it for me because I identify very much with my tradition. And our word for sissy in the Norwegian, the Old Norse, was child lover. The guys that were so squeamish they didn't throw the little children up in the air and catch them on their spears if they took a town or something. And yet the Lord could reach this Norwegian. He can do anything on this earth when that's happened. So, and that's our hope. We can close on that note because it's possible.